How long have you lived in New York?
Like 4 years, I think.
I'm going on to 2 years now.
1 year?
3.5 years.
Have you felt unsafe at all in the city?
No, I never think of that.
Someone was punched in front of the Stern, NYU Stern building by, yeah, like several people, I think. 5 out of 6 of them are Asian. So they think it was like kind of a racial issues.
The subways recently have been a little, you know, kind of out of whack recently. I work like really long hours and I'll be going home very late and, you know, I have to constantly be like switching trains or switching cars.
But I'm definitely more aware of like being my own race and like knowing that that puts me at a higher risk than other people.
I had my friend buy me a pepper spray and then also like listening to the news. I'm Korean, so like hearing about Christina Yuna Lee affected me a lot.
We're gonna go to our base stance. So take your right leg back and yell stop. And once.
Stop.
Louder.
Stop.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright, and you're listening to a martial arts class I recently visited in Lower Manhattan, just on the edge of Chinatown.
Stop.
1, 2.
There's a couple of young jockey-looking guys at the front of the room, but everybody else, and I say this with true love, everybody else is a bunch of little old ladies learning how to punch somebody in the neck. This class is one of a handful that have popped up in cities around the country in response to a series of awful attacks on Asian Americans. The numbers themselves are alarming, a doubling and tripling in reports of anti-Asian violence since the pandemic began. But just as devastating, to me at least, is the terror these attacks have triggered in many communities. People who once felt liberated by the chaos and the jumble of urban life now feel stalked within it instead. And so these ladies, they have asked for help getting their swag back.
Hi, my name is Sammy Yen. I am one of the co-lead instructors of Team Self-Defense New York City.
Sammy's dad taught him Tai Chi when he was 10 years old, and he's been studying martial arts ever since. Taekwondo, MMA, Muay Thai, he's done it all. And yet, when stories about attacks on Asian New Yorkers began to circulate, he was as shook as anybody else.
I felt at first very frustrated and angry, and having 2 kids of my own, I didn't know how to tell them that they had to be more careful and more aware of their situation and defend themselves, you know, if something unfortunate happened. And that really kind of broke my heart. And then I realized that there's a lot more I could do, and being a lifelong martial artist, to translate my skills into helping other people, you know, move freely throughout the city and feeling just more comfortable about going through their day.
So when the Jason and Alicia Lee Foundation invited him to create a self-defense class, he was ready, though he'd probably object to my description of his class as teaching you how to throw a neck punch.
Self-defense is really about spatial and environmental awareness, and I think there is a kind of a misunderstanding of what self-defense is. It's like, I'm not going to teach someone how to like fight off 5 people at the same time in like 1 hour session. And that's really about avoiding the whole situation in general and being aware of your environment.
Like, nobody here is going to become a Marvel hero. That's not the idea.
Unfortunately, if you signed up to become the Black Widow, you have to get your money back. So, yeah, that's not the idea. It's always about just avoiding the situation, being aware. And, you know, time is your best friend. The sooner you can spot a threat, the more time you have to get away. Good, nice.
Sammy's classes have gotten so popular that the Jason and Alicia Lee Foundation have made them available all over town. We'll put a link in the show notes for this episode if you want to find a class yourself. But Sammy's class reminded me of a show we did a few weeks ago. We talked about the fact that a lot of people don't feel safe lately. And tonight's a bit of a follow-up to that conversation. When we don't feel safe, it changes the way we see ourselves, the way we see each other, and the way we build community together. The cycle of violence and fear is just corrosive. And I'm curious about how it's changing the way Asian Americans relate to their cities. So I reached out to Joanne Yu. She's the executive director of the Asian American Federation, which is a pan-Asian nonprofit that represents a network of groups working in Asian American communities around the Northeast. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Sadly, the pandemic has been a particularly difficult time for Asian American communities all over the country, and certainly here in New York. And I have to say, now 2 years into it, it seems to me like the issues that you have been working to combat, the hate crime and the bigotry and all the rest of it, have actually gotten worse. Is that how it feels to you? Am I overstating it?
I don't think you're overstating it. That's certainly how me, as a head of the Asian American Federation, the Asian American Federation staff, that's how we're feeling. Mm. But I think now the feeling is the entire Asian American community. And I'm going to, you know, be brave to say, I think this is now what New York City is also feeling. Some of the incidents that have happened, you know, the subway, you know, some of the killing, right? I think all New Yorkers are feeling it. And I think we're all just incredibly stressed out by it. We're Asian American communities angry, we're in anguish, and just so much sadness in our communities. Yeah. And the feeling of being afraid to leave our own homes.
Yeah. How would you characterize, just for folks who don't know the data, but beyond the data, how would you characterize sort of the arc of this trend from early 2020 to now? How would you paint the picture for people?
You know, there's always a lot of people ask me, oh, you know, is this the start of violence in Asian American communities? The reality is we've always had violence. I think this is a time when there's been heightened violence. And now the violence is being televised and it's happening with tremendous frequency. Mm. You know, we were the Asian American community, the leaders, we knew what was coming because we had seen this with the South Asian community after 9/11. And, you know, some of us got that sinking feeling in our stomachs when we heard the news that there was a virus that was in Wuhan, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I tell people I know exactly when I heard the news and said, oh, my God. And it doesn't help that, you know, our former president didn't call it COVID or didn't call it coronavirus and called it China virus, called it the Kung flu. You know, when that happened, you could actually see the spike of people telling us, oh, by the way, somebody spat at me. By the way, on the bus, somebody punched me. We saw the spike. And then we were hoping that, you know, things would calm down. I know that, you know, President Biden and our state and our city leaders, they all stepped up and said, this is not acceptable. However, I think there's another factor that goes back. It's historic, right? And it's very much the invisibility of Asian Americans. And so how this plays out in my life, and I think this is many, many Asian Americans, people ask us, where are you from? Mm-hmm. Right. And we say, I'm from Brooklyn. No, where are you really from? Mm-hmm. Like really from, right? What is the assumption that we're not from here? What is the assumption that we are not Americans? And so I think in many ways, subconsciously, we are not seen as Americans. So therefore, if you want to harm somebody, it's easy to harm somebody that you think is not from, who is not American. And I think that is what's happening.
I wonder, I think a lot about, honestly, that, you know, when you talk about the invisibility, right, and the fact that the invisibility of a given community, but this Asian American community in this case, but this pattern happens in other communities as well, where there's an invisibility in the public conversation. And then when there's a problem, when there's violence like this, suddenly there's this hypervisibility around the violence. And I actually just as a journalist have struggled with how to think about that. Like if invisibility was part of the problem in the first place, and now all the visibility is about, oh my goodness, they're victims. Does it make the problem worse? I don't know.
I don't know, but that's a great question. And I'll say, you know, when all of this happened, when the pandemic happened, being at home and the lack of food and seniors being afraid, right, to leave their homes because they didn't know how to go get a vaccine, all of that, the invisibility, how it played out was that there were never enough resources on the ground for us to be able to respond. Mm. I don't think this is just the Asian community. I think this is actually communities of color. I've seen the Black community. I've seen the Latino community. I think that's what we get for not having true investments in Asian, Latino, Black communities that we can respond to crisis. And then on top of that, how do you deal with the anti-Asian violence? And so I think invisibility is really dangerous. Obviously, we know what that is. But sometimes I think about why is it that our community is, people think it's easy to take out their frustrations on the Asian American community, and they think we're vulnerable, and we're really angry about that. We are New Yorkers. We live in this city. We live in this country. We contribute to making this country very special. This is an amazing experiment. And yet, here we are having to deal with so much anger and so much violence right now. And it does feel like it's getting worse. And, you know, Kai, sometimes it's really tough to get out of bed because there was a period when I was afraid to open my email, afraid to listen to the news.
Because you thought you'd see another report of a
absolutely. Absolutely. And these days it's the same thing. I you know, there are days when, you know, personally being the leader of the Federation, there are days when I just look out the window because I don't know what any of this means. I don't know why we're targets. We have nothing to do with what is happening.
Well, you know, just to really take that seriously for a minute, that question of why, because I sometimes find it hard to believe that it was simple as like, oh, well, Donald Trump said, you know, that this was a virus to be blamed on Chinese people. And then like people just were like, okay, well, I'm going to go beat up people that I think that look Asian to me. It just seems like there's something deeper there. What really do you think is behind it? Is it as simple as fear of COVID? It feels like it's more than that to me.
I think it's fear and frustration. You know, what we saw, you know, to be honest, I feel like what COVID exposed was just all the cracks in our system, right? And people lost jobs and people died and having to be home for 2 years and everybody feeling vulnerable. And folks needed to assign blame to somebody. And so I think it was a ready target. Mm-hmm. And I think when people are frustrated and they need to take out their anger on someone, something, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it's easy to point the finger at where you think this originated, right? Yeah. I think it's easy to do that.
I'm talking with Joanne Yu, head of the Asian American Federation. Coming up, I'll ask Joanne about the economic impact of hate crime on Asian American communities. And we'll get into some uncomfortable questions about the relationship between Black and Asian communities. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with Joanne Yu. Joanne leads the Asian American Federation, which is a network of groups working in Asian American communities around the Northeast. We're talking about the spike in anti-Asian hate crime and bigotry over the past couple of years and the impact it's having on Asian American communities. Joanne, when this first was beginning back in February 2020, you were a guest on WNYC's Brian Lehrer show. And among other things, you said then you encouraged people to visit their local Chinatowns to help, you know, combat this sort of fear and the racism and the xenophobia. And I have to say, now it seems like those places, those cultural hubs, are actually the center of some of these attacks. And I hate to sound some kind of way, but I wondered if you'd give that advice now. I wonder if people in the community would actually prefer not to have strangers showing up.
No. My some kind of way feeling right now is, can our fellow New Yorkers go to the Asian enclaves, go to the restaurants, go to the shops? One, because Asian American small businesses close much earlier. Mm. They close as early as February. And at some point we worked with MasterCard. They did an analysis of customer spending during, you know, the height of COVID. Chinatown and the Asian enclaves, they lost, you know, Chinatown lost 95% of customer spending in the first year. You know, those are huge numbers. 95% of your business is not happening. So how do they sustain themselves? I remember when all of this started, the Lunar New Year that year, there wasn't the traffic. There wasn't the solidarity. You know, I think it's, you know, Lunar New Year, that's when everybody is Asian-American, right, in New York.
Right.
None of that happened. And people, small businesses were closing. And I think right now, as we're slowly emerging out of COVID, we're starting to open our cities, I encourage people. And I think what this also shows is the violence in our community, the solution isn't just for the Asian-American communities. We can't hide in our apartments. We need to go to work. We need to feed our families. We need to send our kids to school. Our seniors need to go out for walks. All of this, we need to come back out of our homes, and there's safety in numbers. We need to see some solidarity from our fellow New Yorkers. We need to see deep empathy. Everybody is horrified by what they're seeing, and how they can show up for us is by going to the restaurants, supporting the small businesses who've just been hurting. What was so painful with the small businesses is that some of the institutions have permanently closed because they cannot make it. And it's the lack of customers, but also their own fears and their own fears for their staff members. So on every level, it's been devastating, economically devastating. The first time I walked through Chinatown, I cried because it was so devastating to see all of this, you know, every other storefront closed. We know what it takes for a family to open a small business. That is their entire retirement. Yeah. So when that closes, my fear is not just the restaurants and the small businesses closing, but what happens to that family and that economic security that they were building, it's gone. So I wonder, what are they doing for money? How are they doing? What's going on? You know, what's happening to the family nest egg that no longer exists? So those are the things that
And the echo effect, the echo of the long-term effect of that, what it's going to mean to the community.
Absolutely.
Related to that, though, I also just sort of to think about it in another direction, the long-term effect. I wonder about the long-term effect on the community emotionally and just how people relate to the city as a consequence of having been through this experience of feeling so unsafe. I mean, do you worry about how this might change the way individual Asian Americans think about their relationship to others in the city?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what makes me really sad is that now we look at each other differently. We look at our fellow New Yorkers differently. And that's what, as a human being, as a New Yorker who loves the city, that is just one of the most painful part of all of this, because we have all of a sudden looking at each other with distrust. We can't trust our fellow New Yorkers.
Yeah.
We're looking at each other suspiciously. Are you going to be the one to push me off the subway, right? Yeah. Are you going to be the one to punch me in the face? That hurts me so much. And where that hurts me personally is, you know, I tell people all the time, I'm one of those New York City subway weirdos where if you sit next to me, you're going to talk to me, right? I'm going to strike a conversation with you, right? Whether it's one station or five stations, we're going to talk a little bit, right? And we don't do that anymore. And it's so hard to do that because everybody is so paranoid. And I am trying to recenter my thinking that I don't want to live in a city where I'm suspicious of my fellow New Yorkers. But right now, the Asian American community, we're at a boiling point. I think we have gone beyond the boiling point. We are angry. And my fear is next time something happens where there's really negative interaction by the assailant and the victim, right? What is that going to look like? I hold my breath every single day when I hear.
What do you mean?
You know, I've read reports that there are a lot of young Asian Americans who are angry and they're afraid. So they're going to other jurisdictions to buy guns, right? What if there's a negative interaction on the subway? Some, you know, young kids are screwing around and somebody gets freaked and pulls out a gun. What is that going to look like? That, I hold my breath every single day.
And we've been here before, Joanne, right? Like, we've been here before with many different communities, you know, thinking about the history between the Black and Jewish community in Brooklyn, for instance.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is what, you know, that's what scares me a lot, to be honest. And I, you know, I'm going to say, as a person of faith, I believe in putting my fears out there because everybody is going to be sharing this fear with me. But I think this is very much the world we live in, and we have to acknowledge that because we need to make conscious choices, right? But the other side of that, too, for the Asian American community, what baffles me is one day you're coming to the restaurants, you're going to K-Town, you're going to Chinatown, you're going to Jackson Heights, you're going, the interaction with the Asian American community, you didn't even think about it, right? That's what you did as a New Yorker. When COVID hit, all of a sudden, you saw us differently. And I want to know why that is. We're still your neighbors. We're going through the exact same thing you're going through. We're having the exact fears. We're having to scramble for vaccines, and we're having to wear masks, and we're frustrated, and we're losing jobs too. What has changed?
You know what, Joanne? It makes me think about, I mean, in Black community circles, we often talk about that people love Black stuff. They love to buy Black stuff and Black culture, but they don't love Black people. And people love hip hop. People love things they associate with Blackness, but not Black people. And I hear you saying something similar.
Absolutely. And it's exactly the same thing. You love all things Asian, right? Look at the rise of the Korean music culture. Look at the Korean films, right? They're, you know, Clap Clap Cat award winning. But yet, why don't you love Asian Americans? We are Americans. We are your neighbors. You love things from Asia, but you should also love things from your own neighbors. Why is that not happening? And you know, maybe that is a existential question that we can't answer, but that is what I think about all the time. I totally hear you, Kai. I think there's a lot of similarities, and yeah, I wonder.
But there is one thing I don't want to talk around is, you know, there is a perception, and I think it's rooted in just the actual cases of many of the people who are attacking Asian Americans, at least in New York, have been Black. And I do worry about where that goes. And particularly the relationship between Black New Yorkers and Asian American New Yorkers. And I just wonder if you hear that conversation in the community, and if so, what we do about it.
I'm glad we need to talk about this. This is, you know, we tiptoe around these hard subjects, but if we're ever going to get out of this, we need to tackle these questions and tackle these perceptions together. We are talking about that. There are people who say, what's going on? And I'm sure I'm going to get a ton of hate mail to be like, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. But if you really look at the national trends, first of all, right, it's not the Black community attacking Asian Americans, right? Mm. There are the national reports, it's whites attacking. Mm. I think some of the high profile cases, we don't talk about that, right? Some of the high profile cases have been Black assailants, but they're homeless. They're mentally ill. So as we talk about the situation, if we start to peel back the onion, right? Peeling back the onion, we need to talk about chronic homelessness. We need to talk about who the homeless are, who's suffering from mental health, and what is happening in our community. I think in our society, I think we can't talk about anti-Asian hate crimes without talking about everybody else around us. Mm. There have been so many conversations that I've been a part of where even Asian Americans don't know the history of collaboration between Blacks and Asians. And, you know, one story I tell often, you know, the modern Asian American social justice movement came with the death of Vincent Chin. And we're going to be in June, it's going to be 40 years, right? Mm. That was a local Detroit case. That year, Reverend Jesse Jackson happened to be running for president. He heard about this and he said, my community has to deal with this all the time. I'm going to go lend my support because other communities cannot replicate what is happening in the Black community. So he brought his entire national press entourage with him and made it into a national story. Yeah. And so he certainly played a huge role in creating the modern Asian American social justice movement. And, you know, I tell this story repeatedly because it's not just about us doing our own thing. It is about communities that have long history of marginalization, about enduring violence, and how these collaborations have come together to be able to support each other. And as I think about all the anti-Asian violence, I think about paying it forward, right? Because I know that next time it's going to be some other community. How will the Asian American community, having endured all of this, how will we show up for them? How will we show up and say, you know, we went through this and it's just, you know, immeasurable pain and sadness and frustration, how do we show up for the next community that happens? I pray to God that there isn't a next community, but this is how racism works. It poisons the waters, right? And so everybody is, you know, some other community surely will be victims. And it is really about the work that we need to put in, solidarity work, and the fact that whether we like it or not, we live in the same city. We share the same space. We breathe the same air, right? How are we going to get out of this together? Because if you're starting to be afraid of people who are your friends before, or if you start to look at your friends before and you think suspiciously, we're never going to get out of this. So we do need to have some radical thinking. We do need to figure out some way to trust each other.
But before I let you go, Joanne, it pains me so to hear people I love and respect say what I've heard you say in the course of this conversation about this has changed the way I go about my life and the way I engage with the city. And I just wonder what you would say to, you know, folks in the community, Asian Americans in the community who haven't had the luck of engaging with the resources you provide or haven't found support, just what you would say to them if they're feeling that.
There's lots of help available. There are trainings you can take to keep yourself safe, because we don't know if, nobody wants to be the next victim, but you never know. So there are trainings, there's de-escalation trainings, situational awareness. But for my fellow Asians, I want them to know it's okay to be angry. I think, we often hold our breath. It is okay to be angry, because what is happening is atrocious. And it is okay to be sad. It is okay to cry, because it is very, very emotional. And I haven't had a day where I haven't finished the day in tears. I'm welling up now, so I'm going to hold it all in.
It's okay. You cry.
But I also want to say to my fellow New Yorkers that this is the state of your Asian neighbors. This is how we're living. We're scared. We are devastated. And we are really a community in anguish. We ask you to look out for us. I think, racism, the way we get out of all of this is that we have to support each other and we have to stand up for each other, because it's not just anti-Asian hate. As we dig out of this pandemic, we're going to need each other's support. And I think that is the first step that we need to take together.
Joanne Yu is the executive director of the Asian American Federation, a membership organization that works with over 60 nonprofit groups that represent and support the Pan-Asian community. Joanne, thanks for this time, and thanks for the work you're doing on behalf of our city.
Thank you so much, Kai. Wonderful conversation.
After I spoke with Joanne, she had a question for me, which means a question for all of you. So I want to let her ask it, and I hope those of you with thoughts will send them in. It's a big, woolly question, but it's also kind of the one at the root of our show. So here's Joanne again.
How do we really do the work to make people see each other, the humanity in each other, right? I keep saying, we need to see who we are, the best of ourselves. We need to see that in other people, in our fellow New Yorkers. And so if you have any ideas for us to, get people out of their homes and like hang out in their neighborhood, I tell my staff, I'm the nosy auntie who sits on my stoop and says hello to everybody, right? I know who they are. I don't know their names, but I know how to wave and I know how to say hello. But if you've heard ideas that, I'm up for trying for anything at this point. So if you have any ideas, please let us know.
Send them to us at anxiety@wnyc.org. You can record a voice memo on your phone and send that in, or you can just write out an email. We'll get all your answers together and send them to Joanne, and we might use them for another show. That's anxiety@wnyc.org, and thank you. Now, Joanne said that what maybe pains her most is the change in the way New Yorkers see each other, how her own joy in unpredictable run-ins with strangers, how that is increasingly replaced with fear and distrust. People love cities for all kinds of reasons. For me, the randomness of it, the potential for unexpected encounters that open my mind to new things, that's a treasure of my own New York life. So, coming up, we celebrate the random encounters of urbanity with someone who's dedicated a year of her life to finding them through through food. That's next.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. Do you have a response to Joanne's question? What can we as individuals do to make our cities feel more like welcoming communities, to really see and connect with each other? Joanne was asking with the spirit of how to prevent xenophobia by building personal bonds, and that's had us thinking more generally about how we can connect with each other. You know, for me, this strikes a personal chord. I moved to New York City during the pandemic, and frankly, it's been hard to build community. I can tell you one very small thing I've started doing. If there's a package for my neighbor in the lobby of my building, I'll bring it up for them and leave it at their door. Your idea can be that microscopic. So now it's your turn. Have you figured out something that's worked for you? Maybe you hang out on your stoop like Joanne, or maybe you're not from a big city, but you already know what works to build that neighborhood feel. We can all learn something from each other, I think. So please send us your ideas. You can record yourself on your phone or just write a message and email it to anxiety@wnyc.org or tweet us. Use the hashtag USofAnxiety. All right. Thanks. Happy to call you my podcast neighbors. Talk to you soon.
One of the great things and the things that people love about New York is the chance encounters that you can have.
Yeah.
There's that saying, like, that was so New York.
Yeah.
And everyone knows what that means.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, has there been any chance encounter or story that comes to mind of a chance encounter or discovery you made that felt really New York?
Well, someone came to ask for my number, I guess, if that counts.
Did you give the phone number?
Yeah, I did. He said, do you want to go out for dinner tomorrow with me? And then I said, I'll see. And I gave him my number. And then that's it. He never replied me or anything.
Oh, no. Well, if you hear back, send an email to anxiety@wnyc.org and update us all.
Oh, just the other day, I was, like, walking to the train station. I met someone who was, like, in a really cool, like, outfit. There was just so many colors and, like, different fabrics and things like that. And then he had a dog walking with him who also was, like, dressed up. So I just, like, talked to him for a bit as we were walking.
What did you talk about?
He just, like, told me about his dog. He talked a lot about how, like, he just sees his clothing and, like, his dog is a way to, like, bring joy to other people.
Can you share a time where you had a random encounter that stands out to you?
When I first moved here, I come here to Washington Square Park a lot just to sit and people watch and read. I was sitting over near the fountain in the middle, and this girl, she's like, I've been just sitting here, like, watching you. And she's like, I just want to take your picture. I take pictures of people that I just, like, find very interesting and just, like, very nice energy to them. I take pictures of them whenever I travel, and I save them. So I want to take a picture of you. And I was literally, like, on the brink of tears. I was like, that's so sweet. But that was, like, a New York moment, you know, that I hold that, like, very dear to my heart. Yeah.
What about you?
We are sitting in Washington Square right now on a bench. And I was doing that a few days ago. I sit down with a roast pork bun on this bench. And the guy next to me looks at me and says, it's so funny that you're eating that right now, because I just smoked a whole joint and thought to myself, I'm gonna go to the Chinese bakery and I'm gonna get a roast pork bun. And he noticed that, and I was sitting right next to him, and we had a laugh, and that was a cute little moment. It was a cute little bonding moment about food. Something completely different, but we both like the same pastry.
And I love the moment of bonding over food.
In New York City, and in many dense cities where private space is a luxury, so much of our social life takes place in public. In the streets, in parks, and on stoops, and over food. We go out to eat a lot, whether it's a fancy dinner or an egg and cheese in the park. And that means food and restaurants are so very often the vehicles through which we experience each other, and through which we discover, often by accident, new people, communities, ideas that change us. So when we thought about how to celebrate the surprising random encounters of city living, we thought about food and about someone who's dedicated the whole of this year to an exercise in discovery through eating. Tammy Teklamariam is New York Magazine's new diner at large. Her assignment, which began in January, is to eat as much of this city as she can while writing a weekly newsletter about her journey. It's called The Year I Ate New York. So we called up Tammy, and she took us out to dinner. Hey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm Kai.
I'm Tammy.
Nice. We're in Lower Manhattan, in the East Village. It's an area actually known for Ukrainian food, but on this particular corner of First Avenue, there's a small cluster of popular South Asian spots.
We're on a block with a really well-known Indian restaurant with lots of flashing lights, but next to that is a lesser-known Sri Lankan restaurant called Sagiri, and it's one of my favorite restaurants in New York.
When we asked you to take us out to eat, why here?
Yeah, so I mean, the first time I came to this restaurant, it was just kind of by accident. A friend and I couldn't get into the restaurant we planned to. I think they were closed that day. So she was like, do you want to try some Sri Lankan food? I was like, that sounds great. And then the food came and it was just, honestly, there's one curry here that's extremely spicy and I love that. So that's really like a dish that I always come back for.
Well, let's go in.
All right, great.
Sagiri is on the second floor. You go up a flight of metal stairs and you walk into one of those quintessentially downtown Manhattan restaurants. It's like a shotgun apartment, long and narrow, with the kitchen at the far end, maybe five or six tables running along each wall. We take the catbird seat at the one table in the front window overlooking First Avenue, where a brightly colored Sri Lankan flag flies over the sidewalk. I asked Tammy about her sort of gonzo assignment, a year of eating out in New York. She moved here 8 years ago, one of thousands of 20-somethings who migrate here after school. And in her case, after growing up in a close-knit Eritrean-American family in the D.C. area, she'd gone off to study food and wine in France, and then landed here in New York because it offered the greatest diversity of food and wine she could find anywhere. And now, she seems to have taken this gig as kind of a challenge to have as many random encounters as possible in this incredible, unpredictable, massive town.
Random encounters are, I think, my specialty. But I think, you know, New York is great because if you are like me and you have such an addiction to variety, you can really indulge any kind of whim. And that attracts a certain kind of person. If you have any curiosity about New York, you know, the first thing you're going to do when you move here is just get on the train and, you know, try to figure out what sights to see, you know. And I think that a lot of what I did when I first moved here, at least, was just go to different neighborhoods and try different foods. It's such an easy way to enjoy the city.
I mean, this restaurant itself for you was a random encounter, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I've told lots of people about it, and now I've told everybody in New York about it, which is really great. Because I think when people ask, what's your favorite restaurant, they conflate that question with, like, what is the best restaurant in New York or something. Mm. And I think there are very different standards for, like, what you might rate a restaurant as versus how, you know, a person comes to personally value a place in their life. Mm. You know, I still can't speak to, like, all of the great New York places that everybody, like, should go to yet. I'm still, you know, dining as quickly as I can. I'm at over 100 restaurants right now. I think, actually, yeah, just
this
year.
It's barely April.
Yeah. I know, I'm working hard.
Okay, so Sri Lankan food.
Let me get you guys the menus.
Okay.
And I set up the table.
Yes.
Yeah?
While we wait, I asked Tammy to explain what she learned on her first encounter with Sagiri.
Yeah, so Sagiri is the, as far as I know, the only Sri Lankan restaurant in Manhattan. And there aren't that many other Sri Lankan restaurants in New York. I've actually recently learned there is at least one in Queens, but the majority of the Sri Lankan restaurants and the Sri Lankan community is based in Staten Island. So Sri Lankan food is really interesting because at the outset you might think, oh, you know, it's next to India and like a lot of the food appears Indian. But it does have a lot of these other influences, particularly I think like Sri Lankan use of spice is very unique and it has a lot of cardamom in it. And it's like, it's very surprising to me. And then they also have just like a lot of dishes that are inspired by the history of colonization. So they were colonized by the Portuguese and the Dutch and the British, and the Portuguese and Catholicism is why they eat pork, for example. And, you know, the pork curry happens to be one of my favorite dishes here.
I'm not quite sure I get it yet, this mix of South Asian spice and what I think about is kind of bland fare of those colonizers. But we meet our server.
I'm Kavisha. Kavisha Grusing. I'm the manager.
And Kavisha walks us through the menu. I definitely want to try Tammy's favorite dish, that black pork curry.
So the black pork curry normally is really good with rice and different kinds of vegetables. That's how we normally eat it. But the black pork curry is also really good with hoppers. Hoppers, it's crispy on the outside, dense in the middle. One of them comes with an egg.
Our conversation with Kavisha, of course, turns to the pandemic, as all conversations do these days. Sagiri barely made it through the past couple of years.
We were closed for almost a year, mainly because of a gas leak. So we had to rebuild everything from scratch.
That's the thing about the pandemic. In the same way that the virus is harder on people with pre-existing conditions, the economic and social costs have been most taxing for people and businesses that have had to face any other kind of problem at the same time.
Once we recovered, we weren't able to get all the things that we needed from our country. For example, the dry fish, we bring it from our country. So we couldn't get those. Some of the spices, we couldn't bring it here. So we've closed and...
We talked in previous episodes about the torn social fabric. The way that even as we emerge from isolation, we do so damaged. That's one theory about the rise in violent crime and the insidious feeling that our cities are suddenly dangerous, different. And the loss of small neighborhood restaurants, that's one of the tears. Who knows how many closed? At one point in 2020, an industry group in New York said nearly 5,000 in the city had already shut down for good. Another report said the worst of it was here in the East Village, right where Sagiri sits. But it is also true that as a lot of us look optimistically towards spring and summer, restaurants like Sagiri can be a place to repair the social fabric.
And when we opened, a lot of people who have been waiting to come came, and we were actually thrilled to know how many people loved our restaurant, and it was a real joy. We didn't think we'll be able to recover because been closed for so long, but thanks to all the people who have loved us, they came back, they kept coming, so that kind of helped to get back on our feet.
When Kavisha brings us the famous black pork curry, it looks deceptively simple. It's these tender, juicy chunks of meat just sitting in their own rendered fat. It's not saucy in the way I think about curry. Instead, it's covered in a spice that's like a dark, almost inky paste.
What makes the black curry black?
So it's the roasted curry powder. It goes a lot of spices, and we roast it up until it gets really dark. I think they add about 16 spices, at least minimum. I'm not really good at the name of the spices. They mix everything together.
They talk food, but I eat. The pork is so tender and earthy, and honestly, it's not that hot to me. So I go to town.
So excuse me, spike on.
Tammy pours me some of the fancy sake she's brought along.
Have a sip of this.
The restaurant is BYOB, by the way, which is a huge relief on the wallet in this town.
Kanpai.
Kanpai.
What do we think?
That's delicious.
Yeah.
That's good delicious. Sake. That's good sake. All right, well, describe the sake. I would
The pearls of simplicity. So this is a Jinmai Daiginjo, which just means that it's made from rice that's really been polished. So the whole point of polishing rice is that the outer part of the rice grain has a lot more proteins in it.
She gives this lovely tasting note about the salinity and the chemistry and all the rest. But the point is, when it comes to spicy food, sake is kind of like a glass of milk.
And the gentle sweetness, and it's not like a sugariness, but the gentle round sweetness of sake and low acidity makes it really good for really spicy things.
You know, as you describe it in such detail there, I have to name that it's like, I don't know what to make of this, but it's something to say about being in New York. Like, we're three black people sitting in a Sri Lankan restaurant drinking Japanese wine.
I didn't even think about that aspect, but maybe that's just like how used to it I am.
Right.
Actually, yeah, what's notable is her. Tammy is a rare black woman in her field, so much so that she's been profiled in the New York Times and New York Magazine, too, before they hired her. That was back when she was still trying to make a career in wine specifically.
Those spaces are honestly so white that it's hard for me to even feel self-conscious.
Her bigger challenge actually runs in the opposite direction. figuring out how to find and follow her own passions amid her particular version of the second-generation immigrant story. On one hand, food is, of course, a big part of that story.
When you're surrounded by a lot of immigrants, especially older people, like, food tends to have a more important place in society because, you know, there are a lot of old women at home, and like the way that they feel important is by cooking and by taking care of their families. And so, you know, it's the textbook, saw my grandmother cooking, blah, blah, blah. But it's true. You know, one day maybe she wouldn't have any clarified butter. So she would have to go through the process of making this like spiced clarified butter. And the way that it smells when you boil a pot of butter with like herbs that somebody smuggled in their suitcase and turn it into, you know, fresh tesme for that day's breakfast. I mean, it's just, it's a big experience. And so,
and yet, watching her grandmother's cook like that, for Tammy, it's a mixed memory.
Were they around long enough to see you become a food professional?
I don't know. I'm kind of estranged from my family.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that something we can talk about, or is it relevant?
It's just like, yeah.
I should say, Tammy is plainly still working through this stuff. But during her journey into the world of food and wine and writing, her family traditions and norms are actually more of a hindrance than an inspiration.
It's just when you're dealing with the supervision, the mindset of people who have ideas that are from a place that you're not from, you know, you're always going to come up against that.
And one of those ideas, it seems, is about privacy, what's acceptable to say and do in public.
If you're taught not to talk about yourself or not to talk about your home life, then you don't. And it makes it very hard to exist in a genre where people spend a lot of time writing about their home lives or being asked about their home lives. You know, old world cultures have such a gossip problem. I mean, that really, like, it ruins a lot of people. And you just end up seeing people who live based on like the fear of the opinions of others, and when you realize that you're like living on under the weight of like somebody else's, you know, neuroses about a person you don't even know, and all of these like ideas about what you can and can't say about yourself, it's really hard to get past that. So even if you have ideas about wanting to write about yourself, you have to figure out who you are. So, you know, I think I just had a real turning point with who I wanted to be, the things I wanted to say, and the inherent restriction that I felt.
Moreover, from an early age, what really excited Tammy was discovery, finding experiences through food that she knew nothing about.
Because I spent a lot of time watching Food Network, too. And so, like, you know,
just as a kid, just, like, looking at Food Network?
Yeah, I mean, it came out when I was, you know, 9 years old, or at least that's when we got it, like, 99. And that was the golden era of Food Network. The shows that they had back then were legit. And, you know, that's when they had Iron Chef Japan. And I was just, like, watching that, you know, as a fourth grader. And it was, there were just so many layers of intrigue for me because, like, I was just like, what are these ingredients? What is bonito? What is abalone? Like, what are, and it was all subtitled and dubbed. And it was such a, you know, rich place for me to just, like, think a lot. I mean, I guess it just taught me, like, how much was out there and how much, like, was left to know.
So now she's 3 months into a year of chasing knowledge by pulling up a chair at random food joints and restaurants around the five boroughs. And one of the big things she's learned in her 100-plus dining encounters so far is that this act, such a common part of New York life, going out to eat, it can be snobby and fetishistic for sure, but it can be something else too.
Like, restaurants should be really, really regular places, and that's the thing that's like kind of disappearing. You know, like, my socialist dream for New York City, if they ever want to give me a city title, it's like, I think there should be like city diners with like unionized employees and bathrooms that anybody can use. And the price of like an egg sandwich is regulated. Kids can get lunch in the summertime for free or something. But there should be like ways for people to be fed and like seated and served, because it's honestly just a very basic form of dignity that serves a purpose. But, you know, it's becoming harder and harder, even at the fringes. It's just becoming more expensive to have restaurants. And you start to worry when the people whose food it is, like, can't afford the food in a neighborhood that should belong to them. But I'm glad, for example, that Siguri was able to stay here, because that would have been a huge loss.
I hear Eric Adams is hiring, so maybe... Well, thank you for taking us out to dinner, us and all of our listeners. It's been lovely.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad that I got to introduce you guys to this restaurant and just all of the delicious things here.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound design by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frohman, and Kusha Navadar. And I am Kai Wright. Keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. Or, of course, next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.